Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donald on the Kitchen show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Octagon.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We come to you once a week here from the studios of KHOI Community Radio. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. I'm going to take you a little time to think about fall and red things. I've been noticing red things besides the fantastic trees, eh? Pretty good with the trees this
year. Yep, yep. It's been hanging on a long time, the yellow and the gold.
Oh, beautiful colors, beautiful. And I noticed last week I was watching Mars, you know, Mars, that planet.
The
up
red
there.
Planet red. Of Mars.
Oh, and it was very red, very ever. I watched that for a while, and it's still up there, of course. And also, I noticed last week, red sky at sundown. Obviously, there must be a lot of stuff in the air out there in the west, because I had some red sun.
What is that old saying? Red sky at night, sailors delight. Red sky at morning, sailors take warning.
Right.
Something like that.
And I can never figure out which coast or which sea they were in, which way they were looking, but it rhymes.
Well, I think I just think it means if the sky's red at night, you'll have good weather. If it's red in the morning,
storm.
I guess so.
Something red. Oh, and there's a lot of late season things. I found some really nice radishes at the farmer's market, which is kind of surprising this time of year. Peppers are ripening, and I do like to wait until the peppers are red. There's apples. I had pretty good raspberries, even though I had to fight the bugs for them this year. The Japanese beetles. And
do they eat raspberries?
Oh, they just get in there and suck the little things dry.
Whoops.
It was, although now we've had a little bit of cooler weather, they're gone. The bugs are gone. I've been picking raspberries, but it's the tail end of things. And the idea of learning to wait for that perfect kind of red. There's red and then there's raspberry red. Wait for things to be raspberry-ish and then it's really good. Donna, speaking of red things, are you sick of tomatoes yet?
Never.
Never.
Well, only local tomatoes, never. It's still, even though we're at the end of the season and it's, you know, it still seems a short season to me because I do not eat fresh. I never buy fresh tomatoes at the supermarket out of season, except for maybe cherry tomatoes occasionally.
Yeah, it's like watermelon. You kind of eat it all.
Eat as much as you can while you can.
Because I'm afraid what happens to those tomatoes that they ripen in warehouses and they aren't really tomatoes. They are tomato-like objects.
No flavor.
Tomato-like
They're used
objects.
For color on the plate, and they're not worth a nickel.
A nickel. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd take them if somebody gave them to me for free.
So
I'm again them.
Wow. So yeah. They are celebration of red things. Red things.
Well, so what do you're picking the green ones and letting them ripen on the counter?
It's a little beyond, but I have been these past few weeks picking a tomato that's kind of half ripe. They do a good job ripening on the counter or in the box with a little newspaper. But we're coming to the end.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, you know, of course, at the end of the season, the tomatoes don't have the same flavor. There's nothing more perfect than the first tomato or the second tomato of the season. That somehow that flavor, I don't know if it's just the longing on your palate or if in truly they do taste better. But the end of the season tomatoes, something I did, Lana gave me some that weren't quite ripe. I let them ripen. They were the Costoludo kind of ruffly ones. And I just roasted them. I cut them in half and roasted them with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. and kind of shrunk them down. They're great roasted. It concentrates whatever flavor is left, and it's a good thing to do with certainly less than perfect tomatoes too.
There you go. Well, joining us at our kitchen table today is Ben Hoch. He's an environmental educator, beekeeper, forager, and maple tree tapper, and many other things too. He's enthusiastic about wild Iowa. He's been our guest before here on the Donalana Kitchen, and it's always good to check in with Ben. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Good. Yeah, I think we could call you a regular these days, Ben.
Yeah.
I'm kind of feeling like it. I don't know if I'd ever want to hold down a seat right next to you every time. I couldn't keep up with you two.
Oh, flatter us. Come on.
Good. Well, we got lots of things to talk about. And one of the first things I want to mention, whenever I can bring a little passion to Central Iowa, I'd be glad to do that. Ben, you're the only person I know in Central Iowa, maybe there's others, but you have been growing passion plants and outside. I mean, who would have thought? Tell us about passion plants.
So I'm still just learning a little bit myself, but when I dove into this foraging world, you know, there's different things that kind of pique your interest, you know, as an Iowan, you know, things that are kind of right on the border of being hardy or not. You know, some of those things are pawpaws. Some of those things are, well, mayapples are hardy here, but they're also kind of a tropical-like fruit that's kind of hard to find. And one that I've always just kind of been interested in, you know, from travels to California, and ever since I read about them growing as far north as northern Missouri, is these passion flowers and passion fruit vines that actually make the fruit you see in your head, you know, tropical, sweet, kind of sour, beautiful flower. And I just kind of jumped at the opportunity to take a shot at them this year.
Well, describe the plant. And yes, the passion flower is just amazing. Describe what goes on with the plant.
So they're a perennial, and they're hardy to, well, I've heard a lot of different things. And I imagine it's one of those things with global weirding and maybe in a nice structure, a nice, an area that's protected, you could probably get away with it. I've heard them being wintered as far north as southern Wisconsin by some people outdoors. But anyway, they're a perennial plant. They die back every year, and they've got a climbing vine that kind of puts out these three lobed leaves, and they'll kind of grab onto things with tendrils and crawl their way up. And almost overnight, they'll start making this little flower bud. And in a couple days, it opens up to this beautiful saucer sized bright pink and blue and purple and yellow and white flower that looks like it just came out of, you know, another planet. It's,
they are beautiful.
Yeah, bees love to pollinate them. The flowers themselves are used in some herbal medicine kind of as a sleep aid, if I remember right.
That's right. They're calming.
Yeah, and if the Japanese beetles don't get to them, which was a hassle for me on these this year, they can luckily get pollinated and start to form a fruit. And the last time I was out there looking at them, I've got some that are getting close to the size of a tennis ball. I mean, that's probably a little bit big of a description, but in between a tennis ball and a golf ball, maybe a large farm egg, you know. And Wow. They start off bright green, and then this species that is hardy, no, questionably hardy up here, it lightens up to like a brilliant yellow and gets nice and soft. And I haven't been out there in about a week to check on them. I know they could use a little bit of a drink, but I'm hoping to get maybe a half dozen this year. And hopefully next year they flower a little earlier, maybe get a few more.
Where did you plant them?
They're definitely a full sun plant. You know, they'll tolerate a little bit of shade. You know, when I was traveling years ago, I saw some in Louisiana that folks were growing in the ground. And they trellised them similar to hops. So this person had plants in the ground about I think it was probably 10 or 15 feet away from the house. And he had little screws going into the siding. And then he had strings going from the ground up to the siding up near the roof. And the vines would climb up to the roof. And then the fruits would just kind of hang down. So you could walk below them like a little bit of an archway and just pluck these passion fruits off. And ever since I saw that, I thought it would be such a cool thing to grow. Now this year, I'm trying them in pots. And since I've done that, I got them in some 5-gallon buckets. And since I've done that, I've learned more about them potentially being hardy to the north of here. So I think this year I'm going to overwinter them in a shed, or maybe, you know, in someone's basement, if I can talk them into letting me bring 20 buckets in their basement. But I think next year I'm going to go ahead and put half of them in the ground. Or maybe even this year if I decide to dig some holes, but, I'm hoping to not have to move the buckets around because I'm more of a perennial, let it kind of hang kind of person. So, I'm hoping that they're going to be hardy up here.
Yay. Okay. What does the passion fruit taste like?
Well, that's a good question. I think we'd have to ask. Yeah, I've never actually eaten one.
Oh, well, I have, and I'm a huge fan. They're rather lemony, but more than lemon. In California, they're grown, they're ornamental. They're very beautiful. They do, as you said, trellising and fences, and the leaves are rather pretty, and the flowers are stupendous. The fruits... So it's kind of like a little shell, and you open it up, and inside there's seeds and then the goop, which is the fruit. It's kind of runny, so it's not like something you can really peel. So you scrape it out, and in New Zealand, for example, they eat a lot of, you may think they eat kiwis, but they eat a lot of passion fruit. So instead of lemon curd, they'll make a passion fruit curd or... they use it a lot in desserts. Like if they make, I don't know why the kiwis, but they make a lot of pavlovas, and they always put, they put kiwis and strawberries and then some whipped cream and some passion fruit curd can go on there. It's like lemon, but better.
That sounds good.
It's really, really good. So, all right. I'll have to,
can you eat the seeds?
You can, you know, they're smaller than watermelon seeds, for example. But usually they can, you know, if you're making a curd, you strain the seeds off.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to have to get one of the things I get my daughter to send from New Zealand periodically, or I have a friend, Catherine, who's a chef there. They will send me a dehydrated powdered kiwi. No, not kiwi. Sorry. Passion fruit. That I use in desserts and stuff. So I will have to get some of that, and we will make something, and you guys will taste it. It is wonderful.
Yay.
Sounds good. Great.
Speaking of beautiful flowers and things, you had an event in your living room. Tell us, there was a flower that happened. Tell us what happened in your living room.
Yeah, so one of the nice things about living above Lana is that she has a green thumb for sure. And whenever she splits her house plants, I tend to get at least one of the first few looks at the extras. And last year, she threw me quite a few different house plants to fit in this nice south-facing window. And one of these is called a night-blooming cirrus, I think it's how you say it. And they're a cacti that they don't have spines or glochids, you know, those little really small irritating ones like most cacti, but they're a succulent and they're native to South and Central America, if I remember right. And they kind of look like, if you're familiar with staghorn ferns, they kind of look like staghorn ferns in the way that they really palm out and they trail, they put up these really long shoots. And I was lucky enough to get one of these beautiful ones from her, and it just grew exponentially this last year.
So and this is indoor all year round plant.
For me, it is. I don't have really good places to put a lot of my house plants outside. I guess I do, but I like to leave the green on the inside, even in the summer. I think, Lana, you keep yours outside, right?
I took mine outside this year. Yeah. It goes in. It's in now. It's in now. It's not a winter thing at all.
And I ended up not making a mistake of not knowing that my water was softened in the house that came out of the sink. So I had been watering all of my plants with softened water for quite a while, which if you haven't done that, a very common thing for them is to start dying back at the tips. So I had to go through this process of flushing all of the salt out of my pots, you know, setting them outside and dumping water through them constantly. And I was kind of concerned about this night blooming cirrus because, you know, leaves were dying back and new shoots were browning. And after this flush, it really sent on this night's new growth, you know. And my new fiance was visiting a couple weeks ago, and we were doing some stuff with the honeybees inside. We were harvesting a little bit of honey and looked over, and we had seen that it had bloomed. One of them had already bloomed, and the next one was going to open up that night.
Ah.
And if you've never seen these flowers, it looks like something out of a Super Mario video game, like the big ones that try to eat Mario as he's coming by. They're a large flower, about the size of your hand, you know, if you kind of pinched your fingers together. And they only bloom for a very short period of time, just a few hours overnight. And
what color?
I was lucky. Yeah, so they're white and kind of pink. They're probably about 6 inches long and open up to be, you know, four inches across. And they're another one of these things that just looks, you know, you're surprised to see them in Iowa. And I was lucky enough to see it bloom. The whole house was filled with this intoxicating floral, ooh, almost winter green was the smell that I really got from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been on here talking before about making cordials, which are like a flower fermented soda, a soda that turns to a wine and then a vinegar. And I decided to snip this beautiful flower off at about midnight and throw it in a quart of water with some sugar and a little bit of vinegar. And it is in an attempt to capture the fleeting nature of this plant.
It is. And one interesting thing about this plant is that the flower comes growing off the side of one of these big flat leaves. It doesn't come up on the stem. It just kind of grows off. It's an alien plant, and it's a nice one to have in your house. It really is. Oh, how I can't wait to see if the cordial experiment works out. Very good.
And when you make the cordial, how long do you let it sit?
Well, I let the plant material sit in there for about a day, and make sure to give it, you know, stir it and give it some oxygen, because that fermentation process, you know, it's an aerobic process. And you can really drink it whenever you want, you know, so you can set them in the fridge after 2 days after the fermentation started, and it's kind of bubbly and fizzy, you know, kind of like a soda.
Do you take the plant material out?
Yep. You strain it after a day. I've actually let this one just sit on the counter, so it's going to be turning into a wine and then a vinegar. I haven't tasted it yet, but it's looking like it's cruising right along. It's definitely bubbling and building up some pressure in there whenever I go and crack it. And I've made cordials, you know, wines out of cactus flowers before, and they usually have a similar smell, a kind of almost a mucilaginous texture to them. You know, you can imagine a succulent plant stores water in a pretty creative way. They've got to deal with a lot of droughty conditions. So it's definitely a unique product.
Fantastic. Speaking of things that are kind of on the edge and are unique here in Iowa, I think you were talking about pawpaws, putting in some pawpaw plants. Plants, it's a tree. Pawpaw is a tree.
Yeah, we're kind of just getting to the end of pawpaw season here. There's probably a little bit of time left for some of the more sheltered ones. But they traditionally range up kind of the east and west coasts of Iowa, farther north on the east coast of Iowa along the Mississippi River. But they're an understory tree, you know, they'll grow to be about 20 or 25 feet tall if you give them a chance, but you know, usually shorter stature than that. And they're North America's largest native fruit. They're about, you know, the really big ones can be over a pound and the size of a mango, and they kind of taste like a mixture between a banana and a mango.
Do you know pawpaw is related to a cherimoya? Are they in the same family?
I don't know. I've never heard of that plant.
It's a tropical.
Alyssmacea, whatever that means to us.
Huh. Well, it's another one that has that sort of banana flavor and that almost soft ice cream texture to it.
Yeah, I was thinking of something you mentioned with the passion flower or passion fruit. It's got seeds swimming around in it, and it's kind of mushy. Not mushy, but banana-ish. Pawpaws.
Well, I kept hearing about pawpaws, and by the time I finally tasted one, I actually was not very impressed. It's a really subtle flavor. We did make pawpaw ice cream one year. I mean, it's sweet, but it's all right. We'll just stick with subtle. Okay.
Yeah.
What do you do with your pawpaws, Ben?
I've made ice cream with them in the past, and mm-hmm. I actually made a mead with them a couple years ago.
Oh,
and
okay.
That was very, very good. Very sour. I was surprised by how sour
really?
It was after. I think it would make a very good sour beer. I think it would also make a very good vinegar. I wish to get out this year and harvest some, but the stars, the pawpaw gods didn't align this season. But next year I hope to go out and harvest a quantity and make, you know, 5 or 10 gallons of this stuff, because it's one of my favorite flavors in a wine or a vinegar.
I could see it as a vinegar because it does have a lot of sugars in it, which would make it ferment really well.
Well, and you'd be surprised, like you say, it's really some of them are fairly bland. But if you get to them, if they ripen completely on the tree, it's also, you know, a lot of times they'll pick a little bit early, and pawpaws are really only ripe for a few days. They're kind of a fruit that's hard to transport. And I was really surprised by how much the flavor changed from fresh to fermented, like how concentrated that sourness.
Does it get sweeter or does it get more fuller flavor when it ripens?
It gets sweeter, but it's also a fuller flavor, you know? I think we'll have to try one on you again next year.
All right. I will remain open-minded. And we'll try it again.
Very good.
Okay.
Pawpaws. Also, you are a forager, and I want to remind people that there are mushrooms that happen all year in Iowa. You found you're finding mushrooms this time of year, aren't you, Ben?
Yeah, I haven't been out a lot lately just because of how dry it's been. But there's still mushrooms that are out there and growing and doing their thing. I was going today to go help a landowner remove a cat from a tree today, and as I'm driving around the countryside, I always keep an eye out for big oak trees. And in the fall, I think of chicken of the woods mushrooms, which are big orange mushrooms that grow on wood. And then I also think of the maitakes, which is Japanese for oak mushroom. We call them the hen of the woods around here, or some people call them turkey tails. But they are a mushroom that can be anywhere from a half a pound up to 60 or 70 pounds. And I saw a picture of one out of Maine from a fella that I met personally, and the mushroom was over 90 pounds. I mean, I was even being, that's not a normal thing. I found one that was over 40 one time.
Well, did they get woody? Did they get
tough? Don't get, No, they don't. If they have perfect growing conditions, it would be completely soft and edible all the way through. But I found this one late, so it was dry and, you know, inedible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basically, if you curled up in a ball, that's how big the mushroom was. But these grow specifically on oak trees, at the base of oak trees, out of the ground. And one tree I saw today, they were too old to harvest, but they had a ring of 7 mushrooms around the tree. And when they were ripe and full and fresh, I imagine there was close to 40 pounds of mushroom around the base of this oak. I pulled a few today off of one that I saw from the road on the property I was visiting. And, you know, one of them was probably fit in the 5-gallon bucket, and it would stick a little bit out of the top. A little bit dry, but that doesn't mean that. Yeah, a lot of things. You can make jerky out of them, so you can parboil them and then reduce the water left over for a broth. After you parboil them, you can squeeze some of the water out and marinate them for a day or two and then dehydrate them. I also like to parboil them and then squeeze some of the water out and then blend them up and mix them with black beans and onions and garlic and farm eggs and spices and make, you know, a mushroom patty out of it. And when you find 30 pounds of hen of the woods, you know, you can clean out your freezer or your refrigerator from oats and those black beans that you've had sitting in a plastic bag for 2 years. And you feel like finally soaking them and getting to using them. Nice putting away that much food for the winter season coming up, for sure.
Mushroom, magic. Ooh, what a good idea, Ben. I'm going to take a little time here to say this is KHOI Community Radio, and you are listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa.
Looking to vote early? Here's what you need to know to vote early in Iowa. First, make sure you're registered to vote. You can find out if you are and register if necessary at sos.iowa.gov. To vote by mail, you can request a ballot by 5 p.m. on October 24th at sos.iowa.gov. where you can also track your absentee ballot's status. To be counted, an absentee ballot must be received by the time the polls close on Election Day or postmarked on the previous day and received by the auditor by noon on the Monday following the election. Your ballot will not be counted unless the outer affidavit envelope used to return the ballot is signed. You can vote early in person at your county auditor's office or a designated satellite location. To find out when and where in-person voting is scheduled in your county, call the county auditor or check their website. This message, a public service of KHOI Community Radio.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about stuff happening here in Iowa right now with Ben Hawk. She does a lot of interesting things, and we've been talking about passion plants and mushrooms and pawpaws. And Ben, you do tree work too. I mean, you're familiar with trees, and you trim them up. And this last derecho storm that went through, you have been busy. Can you tell us what, besides the fact you've been busier than all get out, what have you learned a little bit from the big storm that went through?
I've been working with trees for quite a while now. I guess mostly prairie to start with. It's kind of the opposite, but the same thing. And in the last few months that I've kind of had a crash course in this, I guess I've just taken a couple notes on the species that seem to be most affected by it, as in like coming down or breaking branches or just their structural integrity with these strong of winds, and the ones that dealt with it pretty well. I was doing a bit of brainstorming today and thinking, you know, I'm looking at oaks, I'm looking at walnuts, I'm looking at hickories, you know, kind of the three species that had been here in Iowa historically predominantly on the landscape, especially in upland areas that historically got more wind. They did pretty well. Oaks, hickories, walnuts all did pretty well. I remember ash and mulberries did pretty well. But the trees that didn't seem to hold up the best, at least the ones that I got the most calls about, were trees that two of the species tend to get hollow pretty readily. One of them is the hackberry. Hackberry trees.
Oh, yeah.
They're beautiful. You know, a friend of mine calls them raccoon hotels. I've got a couple of logs out here in behind the house that I'm working on turning into beehives, and that's a whole nother story. They get hollow easily. And when they break, they also don't tend to snap and fall completely off. So that is a little bit of a redeeming quality about them. They're a very stringy tree. So when a branch breaks, they tend to hang there. But that nature of them getting hollow tends to be, there were a few trees I was working on this year. Another one that is probably not a surprise to a lot of people are silver maples. Silver maples, they're very fast growing. They're nice shade. They've got little nice leaf, you know, turns and in the wind, and the bottoms of them are nice and silvery. The first flower to come up in Iowa every year, you know, a nice pollen source for insects that have had a long winter. But they had a lot of branches breaking with the storm. And the last one that I ran into, and I learned I really don't like working on them, is honey locust trees. No matter how strong and rot resistant those trees can be, they tend to snap and they tend to get hung up, and the branches are really, how can I say, they like to grab, you know, they just don't fall. If the branch breaks, it's not hitting the ground. You know, I could be up there and cut a branch and try to toss it, and one out of five are going to land on the ground. The rest are going to get caught up in the tree. It's not like an ash or a silver maple. When you cut it, it can just nicely slide through the branches and fall down to the ground. Not saying I wouldn't recommend planting, you know, a locust, a hackberry, or silver maple, because they're all beautiful trees. But in an area that gets a lot of wind, it may be one to maybe skip this round.
Ah, good thing, because we all learned about trees, especially downtown Ames, and heavens, a lot of towns in central Iowa that had beautiful trees, and there has been a lot of tree damage, a lot of cleanup. I suppose some of that is still going on. Trees.
Most definitely. And I mentioned those hollow trees as well, the hackberries and the silver maples. Those are also two species that very commonly have honeybees established in them, I'm learning. I'd say 70% of the tree calls, I probably got a dozen calls for bees in trees. The trees had broken during the storm and the colony was without a home. 7 out of 10 of them seemed to be in silver maple or hackberry. And it's just amazing to me how many of these trees are on the landscape, even in towns, that we don't even see. I would have never thought that in these suburban and urban areas that there are that many honeybee colonies around us.
That's good news. I like that. That's good news.
Is it because they're up so high we don't see them?
Yeah, they're commonly high up. You know, I think the lowest one that I was able to remove this year with the storm was probably 15 feet up in the air. I did remove one this season that was at the base of a tree, but no, they're usually very high up. One, I did a removal on in downtown Des Moines. It was a large red oak that was a couple hundred years old. And it actually broke off about 12 or 13 feet in the air and then landed on a car. And the trunk shattered into a bunch of pieces. And inside of the trunk was a giant honeybee colony. So not only did these people have a giant tree on their car, they had a giant tree full of bees on their car.
Good story.
Interacting with their environment. Yes, we are. Ben, you always seem to have interesting things to do besides bees and trees and passion plants. You've got a research project coming up. Tell us what your next research project is going to be.
Yeah, well, I was lucky enough to actually get out yesterday and get a start on it. So I do a little bit of work for the Department of Defense, and little do people know, the military bases, they have to follow some of the most strict environmental policies of anyone. So whenever they do any kind of building or troop maneuvers that are going to change how the landscape is used, they have to do archaeological surveys, they have to do water quality surveys, they have to do animal and plant monitoring surveys to make sure that they are not negatively influencing the environment. So I work out the Camp Dodge military base as a contractor, and I've recently picked up a contract trying to relocate an endangered species of skunk for the state of Iowa called the spotted skunk. Now, this is a time of year when skunks and a lot of other critters are trying to pack on the pounds before winter. Skunks don't actually hibernate. They more what you would call brumate. They kind of sleep for a month or so and toss around in a little burrow and come out every once in a while to try to find a little bit of food and stretch their legs and wander into a neighboring burrow to see who else is around. So on warm days in the winter, you know, you'll often find skunks crossing roads or wandering fence lines. This time of year, they're out searching for food and, you know, digging around, trying to find the last few bugs of the year. And this project is looking at trying to find the spotted skunk. So they're a little bit smaller than your standard striped skunk. And instead of having stripes, they're covered in these calico white spots. And they are just, I mean, they are just super cute when it really comes down to it.
Well, are they black, basically, with calico spots?
They are black with, I say calico probably in the wrong way. They're black with white spots all over them. You wouldn't mistaken them for a regular skunk. They'll even have a spot right in the middle of their forehead, usually. So they're slightly smaller than our striped skunks. They're also a bit more carnivorous, although they will kind of eat just about anything like our regular skunks will. They're better at climbing trees. And when they spray, when they get defensive, they do these handstands. They'll actually stand up on their hands and stomp their front feet while they're, you know, they'll stand on one leg and stand on the other and kind of pump their hands on the ground. And if you look up a video, if you look up spotted skunk on YouTube, you know, people call them, oh, they're dancing. Well, they're kind of dancing. They're more angry at who's ever videotaping them. But they're interesting critters in the way that they were never that common in Iowa historically. And I say historically when I say before European settlement. So European settlement occurred. We settled the landscape of Iowa. We built houses and barns. We built corn cribs. We stored our grain outside. And these spotted skunks kind of spread up from the south and the southeast. They extended their range into Iowa to the point where they were harvesting tens of thousands of them, you know, through the 30s and 40s and 50s. And I think it was in the 1970s that they really started to die back. But it was one of these things where about 100 years, it was this really big range extension. And they were eating corn out of corn cribs and burrowing underneath barns and, you know, able to overwinter that way. They also like really thick brush. So I think fire suppression at the turn of the century really helped these species extend their range. But now they're kind of disappearing again. It's kind of one of those things where, as an ecologist, you know, you don't run into a lot of species that their range extended, you know, and now it's dying back again because of human encroachment. It's a unique story. So I set out these camera traps yesterday and, you know, baited them with some sardines because, you know, it's a nice fishy, smelly scent that can kind of waft across the air. And then I drove around with a buddy of mine on the base with a spotlight, and we got to looking for these skunks. We saw deer, and we saw possums, and we saw raccoons, and we probably saw 5 or 6 regular striped skunks, but we did not encounter any of the spotted skunks yet. They hadn't been seen at the base in 5 years now, but I'm hoping that I'll be able to relocate them.
So they're nocturnal.
Yeah, primarily nocturnal. Yep, skunks are. And you just had a really good, got a chance of seeing them when they're out wandering around some of the hay fields or the roadsides, you know, a little bit more likely than during the day.
Ah, very good. Well, I think that's a wonderful project to work on, and they sound cuter than the Dickens, I say. And the idea that the military is... puts out these environmental impact studies on their land. I think that's it. Now, if we could only get them to do that before they decided to wage war on somebody, and you could go in and check things out, maybe we could kind of stop some of their other activities. But it's great. It's great that you are looking for all this stuff on military bases. What
so,
a good thing.
So what do you do if you see one? You're going to try to live trap them and then take them where?
None of the above. I'm not interested in trapping unless it comes down to a lot of the research has been on them. I've read recently about has been using radio telemetry to figure out where they go and where they hibernate. So you put a little collar on them and then, you know, see what burrows they're using in the winter and what kind of the landscape they're moving around in. And that could just better, you know, give you an idea of their habitat.
How do you get the collar on them?
Well, you would need to live trap them, but that, I kind of got ahead of myself. I'm just trying to relocate them on the base. And if I am able to relocate them, you know, just take into account what kind of management practices the base is using and whether or not that's good or bad, if those are the words you want to use.
Well, what do you mean by relocating then? What does that mean? You encourage them to go somewhere else?
They're an endangered species, so they it's important to have long-term monitoring. It's like if you had a rare species of tree that had a very small population in one state forest in Iowa, just because they were healthy 10 years ago doesn't mean they're going to be healthy now. So going out and trying to reestablish that the population is in fact there can lead to future opportunities to try to set up projects to protect their long-term survival on the military base.
Good. Spotted skunks. I will mention again, this is KHOI and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. For more information, go to khoifm.org and support this fine radio station.
Want a tip for some great early Christmas shopping? KHOI's Auction House has an amazing array of beautiful, one-of-a-kind items that you can bid on. You can find a wonderful gift for somebody you love, and you can support community radio. So support KHOI by visiting the KHOI Auction House. You can get there with one easy click from our Auction House button on the homepage of our website, khoifm.org. Community radio is a place where all voices are welcome, where diversity is celebrated, and a place to make connections. With your help, we will continue to be an important resource for news, ideas, conversation, and music. The auction ends October 18th, so be part of our community. Go to the Auction House button on KHOI's homepage at KHOIFM. And as always, thank you for listening and thank you for your support.
We are back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a tune called Pretty Little Dog. Why not? Why not? All right. We are talking to Ben Hoch. And it's funny, this time of year, trees. Trees shed their leaves and they fall on lawns. Donna, are you going to like get out there and rake your lawn pretty soon?
Oh, not me. I don't do that. I am a bad neighbor. Actually, I tend to let it all go and then clean in the spring. And I found a good article this year in the New York Times to back me up. I was so happy to read. It was about, they called it a smarter fall cleanup. And they encouraged you to leave some of the leaves in certain places because it forms a mulch. I mean, you don't want to kill your grass with it, but on certain beds, it's really good for that. It also leaves a place for insects, which we now know we don't have enough of, but they overwinter in the mulch, like bumblebees and things like that. So if you take all of that cover off of your ground, you're losing some of your beneficial insects. So I was really happy to know that being tidy is not always the best environmental thing to do. Ben, do you have any guidelines for fall and, you know, winter preparedness in the garden?
In the garden or related to trees there?
Trees.
I guess I'm thinking less is more.
That's how I feel about it.
The passion flowers are kind of the extreme here because I think I'm going to have to bring them in this year. And but it's not something that I usually try to make a habit of, is having things that tend to be babied. Not that it isn't fun to tend something and look after it and care for it. But it's more of my nature to just plant it and hope that it does what it can do on its own.
Well, I'm in terms of raking the leaves, and they're not all down yet. So I'm still, you know, obviously one has to clean the gutters, you know, and I do rake. One thing I did learn is if you leave too many leaves where you're going to be shoveling snow, it makes it more difficult. So I do rake them away from the gates and on the pathways. But I like to leave a lot of them. I'm not one of these people that scrapes them all up and puts them in big paper bags and gets rid of them. You know, I mean,
what would you rather do with your time?
What did you say?
What would you rather do with your time than that? You know, maybe make some good food and enjoy the color of the leaves falling.
Yeah, there's always something better to do than, although probably some people like raking leaves. I'm not one of them.
Well, yeah, another thing that people seem to like is mowing their lawn. And mowing, it's fine a couple times of the year, but it's kind of nice to go into winter with grass taller. Don't be mowing your ground to its last depth, or mowing your lawn to its last inch there. I mean, leave things.
Yeah, it needs some ground cover, you know?
Yeah, it does. Also, we've had such a dry year, and we have a dry fall. I was so looking forward to rain earlier this week. I think we got a tenth of an inch. There was like,
yeah, I got 10, about 10 drops.
10 drops.
I
it is
them.
Dry. So yeah,
it's time for you to put the garlic in, right?
Not quite yet, but we are preparing the ground. It's another thing that happens in October. I'll wait till the end of October. I like to put it in before a really hard freeze, but we have to kind of turn the ground over a little bit and make those beds. The garlic, it does need to be seen too. Yeah, it does. Ben, you have lots of things in the air, lots of things you do. And if people have questions about trees or bees, or how do people connect up with you, Ben?
Yes, I've got a website that I built this last year, and I've been so busy this summer I haven't updated it, so look forward to that this winter. But the website is ephemeral, ephemeral midwest.com. You can also just type in Front Yard Sugar, Ames, Iowa. That's the name of my maple syrup company, where I, you know, knock on people's doors in the Ames community. And if they have a maple tree, I trade them a jar of syrup for tapping their tree. So you can just look that up, and that'll probably bring you to my website. Yeah, go ahead and check it out. Feel free to reach out if you want to learn about any of the things that I'm getting up to. I know with COVID, you know, keeping distance is important, but I am more than happy to have people come by to talk outside. I've got some pawpaw trees available if anyone wants some free pawpaw trees. I've got a few to part with. I'm happy to be here in Ames and happy to be on the show again, that's for sure.
Great. Well, thank you for being with us and good luck in all the stuff you do. Passion flowers. Wow, what a good, and spotted skunks, that's a good combination. I like that
okay,
a lot.
Okay, and I'm gonna make a pledge to get you a taste of passion fruit in something. I don't know what, but I'll make you something with passion fruit so you can taste it.
Yay.
Nice. I'm going to run out and go check the plants now.
Good. I want to mention, too, that this is community radio, and we are beholden to your goodwill. Yes, we are. Your donations make this radio station happen. And up until this weekend, right now, there is a KHOI fundraising auction going on, and you can go to khoifm.org. That is the main page there. And you'll notice kind of off to the left, there's an auction house button. On that auction house button are lots of things that people are bidding on. And need I remind you, Christmas gifts. What a good idea. And Donna also has an item on there that you just might be interested in. Tell us, Donna, what is on the...
Oh, yeah, I have posted that I will make whoever bids on this a whole batch, which is about 36 or so, of my very famous Michelle Pfeiffer biscotti. So I make a fruit nut version, and the reason they were named that is because it's something I did make for Michelle Pfeiffer a lot when she was my client, and she liked them because they are a delicious whole grain sweet, you know, where you can just munch one or two and it doesn't have any fat in it. So it's fairly healthy dessert.
Good idea.
So go have a bit at the Michelle Pfeiffer biscotti. Okay.
Very good. Very good. Also on that khoifm.org, you can find out more about Dental in the Kitchen. Dental in the Kitchen's been part of this community radio station for, going on our seventh year.
And oh, goodness.
We are here for you to talk about food in Iowa, and we have enjoyed it, too. You can find out more on that webpage. Go to the talk section, go to the Dental in the Kitchen section, and you will find past shows, you'll find recipes, you'll find a picture of both of us.
I think the biscotti recipe is even on there if you want to make it yourself.
I think so too. There you go. Also, want to remind you that winter is on its way, folks. The final farmers market in downtown Ames and probably in other bits of central Iowa. Be sure to visit your local farmers market soon, maybe this coming weekend, which should still be a good fall weekend. Yes, it would be.
Yeah, you can get your pumpkins and squash and what else have we got? Red
apples,
peppers.
Apples.
Yeah.
I gotta start visiting.
Garlic
and all kinds of stuff. So support local growers and get stuff locally and be prepared to kind of hunker in for this winter. And it's nice to have stuff in the kitchen. It's nice to have stuff on your shelf. Very good. So if you want to contact Dental in the Kitchen, you can contact my email. And we'd like to hear what's your thoughts. What's on your plate? You can send me an email, Lana, L-O-N-N-A, at onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us a recipe. Send us your ideas. That would be lovely. That's onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. You've been listening to the Dental in the Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday at noon. We're repeated at 7 p.m. And you can listen to the show by going to khofm.org and poke the Play Now button and find past shows there for the past couple weeks. We had music today by the Barn Owl Band. You heard Stony Point, Pretty Little Dog, and we'll go out with a tune called Green Willis. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Nautico.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
We've had excellent engineering, as usual, by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.
I'm Jerry, Youth Services Manager at Ames Public Library.
And I'm Kathy, Adult Services Librarian at Ames Public Library.
We would like to invite you to join us each week for Reading Radio.
Our show airs each Wednesday at noon and centers on a different theme each week.
The show starts with stories for our young listeners.
And then includes a conversation with all kinds of recommendations related to our theme.
We hope you'll join us. Happy reading.